Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our topic today is what can we learn from history to help guide us in today's crisis? This will be a continuation of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds. My guest from the United Kingdom is Dr. Jim Garrison. Jim is the founding president of Ubiquity University and the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies, an international school of higher education built upon transformational principles of whole brain and whole systems learning. The university operates with partners all over the world. As the co-founder and president of the Gorbachev Foundation, Jim was instrumental in the founding of the State of the World Forum to lay a template for a more sustainable global civilization. In the late 1980s, he served as executive director of the Esalen Institute, Soviet American Exchange, and founded the International Foreign Policy Association in collaboration with Secretary of State George Shultz and the Georgian President Shevardnadze. He is the author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power. He also is the author of Civilization and the Transformation of Power. Jim has graduate degrees in religion and theology from Harvard University and Cambridge University. His websites are ubiquityuniversity.org and wisdomuniversity.org. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Nice to see you and talk to you again, Gary.
Jim, I'd like to have more of a philosophical conversation. Although so much of our world is now being defined and determined by science and technology and politics and ideology, in the old art of philosophical inquiry, which at one time was inseparable from the sciences, has been sidelined at best, and it seems that we need philosophical thought, particularly ethics, more than ever before.
Indeed.
We went through the age of postmodernism when everything became relative. Now we've entered the era of post-truth, when nothing is to be believed as true. Stephen Hawking once gave a lecture at the Google conference and said, "Philosophy is dead, especially metaphysics." In his opinion, as with the majority of materialist skeptics, such as Richard Dawkins, science is all about certainty, even when scientific theories are completely faulty or filled with holes. Now, it's well known that fundamental physics is in a metaphysical mess. Almost 50 years on, the two big theories of general relativity and quantum mechanics have not been reconciled yet. Physicists talk about string theory, but it remains incomprehensible even among those who study it. Earlier, and ancient metaphysical systems at least helped keep societies cohesive. They provided some kind of meaning to life and imbued people's lives with value and purpose. And ethics were associated with a large purpose. But on our age of scientism, the consequence is that more and more people, especially younger adults, growing up in a culture of scientific secularism, experience existential angst. I had the chair of the religious studies from the University of Pennsylvania on the program, and he offered a course entitled Existential Angst. And the course is now the most popular on Penn State's campus, even among students in the med school and the Wharton School of Business. So as a historian and religion and founder of a university, do the earlier or ancient metaphysical and spiritual systems have any value for our civilization today? And what has been the consequence of just cold scientific truth and facts in the absence of a metaphysics or spiritual cosmology that provides deeper meaning? And what can spiritual metaphysics offer to our scientifically based culture and especially our relationship to the earth and nature. The form is yours.
Boy, those are several very big questions, Gary. Thank you very much. You're asking the right ones. And I would say first that I think in the end, the first instincts of human beings several thousand years ago are going to prove the best ones as we face the future. And I think when we realize that, we're going to look back over the last 300 to 400 years since the Industrial Revolution and realize that for several centuries, we lost our way. And I think that what is beginning to happen now in science and cosmology is very illuminating in terms of the truth that I believe is true, whatever you think it is. And I think the whole notion of postmodernism and post-truthism, as you indicate, are going to be seen in hindsight as temporary lapses of reasons, as the Pink Floyd puts it in one of their albums. And we'll see that in the end, the classical understanding is correct. And let me just expound on that just for a second. In the ancient world, the world was seen as unitary. And because it was seen as unitary, they understood that heaven above and the earth below were part of the same singularity. They understood that because everything was interrelated, that science, ethics, economics, psychology, art, philosophy, all interacted with one another and informed one another in a whole that was more than the sum of the parts. And whether it was east or west, obviously there were different differentiations. But if you take, for example, the Buddha in the east, and his great insight was that all was emptiness. Everything is empty, he said, because everything is interrelated. So there's no such thing as an individual ego. There's no such thing as an individual, indivisible unit, because that's in violation of the very nature of things. Everything is interconnected. And because everything is interconnected, there's no boundaries. And in fact, the only boundaries that we make are as a result of our own diluted consciousness. And let's take, for example, Aristotle in the West, living about a couple of centuries after the Buddha in ancient Greece. And for the Greeks, you know, they understood that everything was in the polis, that we were all citizens. And there was no such thing as, you know, no man is an island, individual unto himself. And that the citizens had very specific obligations. And therefore, for Aristotle and the Greeks generally, even though they, you know, had slaves and even though they discriminated against women, nevertheless, their metaphysic was one in which everyone had the obligation to participate in the structures and decisions of governance. And that notion of a unitary cosmos in which the macrocosm and the microcosm, that which is above, mirrors and is interconnected with that which is below, I think came to its apogee really during the Renaissance. And if you look at the Renaissance, that is a moment of extraordinary beauty where the Italian city-states, looking back to the Greco-Roman civilization after 1,000 years of Christianity and the Catholic dogma, that split earth from heaven, God from creation, good from evil, humanity from nature. For a brief shining moment, the Florentines first, and then the city-states of Italy, and then parts of Europe, went back to the Greco-Roman civilization and had a rebirth that we remember to the present day as a brief shining moment when Michelangelo could produce the Pietà, Leonardo da Vinci, the Last Supper, and that education was about ethics and moral judgment and rhetoric to bring the good into the political arena. And then came the Enlightenment. And once again, the Western mind was split. And ethics was divorced from science, the human intelligence from the natural world. And we began an extraordinary process that Ken Wilber, the great integral philosopher, calls flatland, where science basically made everything flat that previously was round. And science, as we all know, because we've studied it in school, took God out of the equation, ethics out of the equation. The universe is nothing but an inert assemblage of atoms without consciousness and without soul. And we've been within the, I would say, the prison of scientific reductionism for a number of centuries. And one of the results of that, as you point out, is that scientists have been unable to arrive at a unified field theory. Because if you make flat that which is round, and you take certain aspects of reality that are bound together with everything else and split them off, there is no way that you can unify the whole. And the agony of contemporary physics is that it's reached the outer limit of that which it can understand. And the point that I'm driving at is that if you've read Fritjof Capra's work, The Tao of Physics, one of the things that's beginning to happen is that as the physicists and the cosmologists look out into the universe and look down into the minutest nuances of the subatomic world, they're beginning to see patterns. They're beginning to see unity. They're beginning to talk about string theory. They're beginning to talk about entanglements. They're beginning to realize that if you move and perturbate a proton, it will affect protons millions of miles away. Why? Because everything is interconnected. And so modern cosmologists and modern physics are now beginning to describe reality in very similar ways to the way the ancient mystics described the cosmos and the reality of the human soul in their meditative states. So I think we're coming to a very excruciating moment in the philosophical and metaphysical history of humanity, where the split that was in some ways necessary to break the shackles of the church 500 years ago in the, you know, the 16th, 17th century with the rise of the Industrial Revolution, the rise of the scientific method, has now run its course. And that which was a solution to a problem 400 or 500 years ago has now become a problem that needs to be solved. And I think it's an extraordinary opportunity for those of us who are embracing the world as one, who understand that humanity is part of the larger ecofield, that know that ethics and science have to be wedded to tame scientific exploration, if by no other law than the precautionary principle, and that morality needs to be universalized so it ceases to be sectarian and begins to be rooted and grounded in the earth itself, and that biomimicry, understanding that we are now creatures of the earth and the planet, and we're here for a reason. Nature produced humanity for a reason. We're not separate from nature. That mentality, I think, is growing, and I'm very happy to see that if you look at the statistics around the United States and the West, that the major religions are breaking down, and the conservative forces are becoming more vituperative and intense. But statistically, more and more people are breaking away from the strictures of a world divided and are embracing the metaphysics, the politics, and the ethics of a world united. And I think, therefore, the crisis is deep, but the opportunities are commensurately extraordinary.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you.
Thank you.
What I witnessed today is a complete lack of universal ethics in our public conversations. There are hordes of chatter espousing the self-serving individual ethics for the wealthy, corporations, for politicians, for cultural cults, including identity politics, trying to convince us of the correctness of their actions. But none of these are grounded in any universal value that stirs compassion and kindness and caring and self-sacrifice or even love. The entire ethos of our culture is the pursuit to succeed and seek self-gratification. Spiritual discussion is absent. Instead, there's a mania to identify the deep humanitarian crisis we face with self-absorbed identities that uplift the needs of the false ego. There have been a huge increase in identity politics, which I disdain, especially in the United States, that should have disappeared decades ago, and consequently nothing changes and the conditions of our world only worsen. In the larger scope, this means that our nation, our civilization, doesn't live within its sustainable means. And I'm going to ask you in a moment to speak about the lack of ethics and universal values today, if you feel that's the case, particularly in America, and how this lack of ethical values in the United States is now spilling over into other nations. But I want to give you first my overarching concern. It'll take just a few moments, okay?
Sure.
We are faced with the greatest threat to our survival in our history, and that is we're in the sixth mass extinction era. We have identified at least 42 different tipping points. Half of them have tipped. Nothing we're going to do is going to reverse those. Others could be mitigated if we started such things as massive reforestation. Let's say 100 million trees per state and 1 billion trees per small country, and up to 10 billion trees like China and Russia per large country, though Russia's got a lot of trees. And if we stopped all this massive spending, and the people who tell us they're concerned are the very people who are consuming the most. They're the ones flying in private jets. They're buying the extra houses. They are addicted to mass spending, and yet the irony that is lost on them is that they're the problem. It's like the people who say, we don't want walls, we want open borders, we want to get rid of ISIS, are the very people who live in walled communities and guarded by armed guards and private security forces in Bel Air and other communities. They're not living with the average person. There's also that you will have 100,000 women go out and protest against Trump, and that's fine. I don't like him or anything he stands for. But the reality is, get those same 100,000 women to go out and protest against hungry children, of which there are 17 million, or the 2.3 million who are homeless, who go to school and have no home to come back to. Let them protest for that, or the children who are dying in Yemen, and the women who have been raped and mutilated and dying in Yemen and also in other countries. And you won't see any march or demonstration. So it's very selective, our outrage. And even right now, there is a major coup in the United States. They didn't like the fact that Trump was elected. They had put all their energy and money in behind Hillary Clinton, and she is a warmongering neocon, and she is known for crimes against humanity, and yet they overlooked all that, just like they overlooked what Barack Obama was actually doing versus his charm. Yeah, he's charming and probably the most lethal president in American history. So we don't seem to be at our brightest right now. We seem to be engaged in only that which serves us ideologically or politically. And so then now there's a coup. Everything to get rid of Trump using the deep state, demonizing all the 63 million people who voted for him as all deplorable, redneck, racist, white supremacist idiots. And yet the latest study shows about 6% maximum of Trump supporters are the alt-right, meaning that could fall into that category. The rest are frequently Bernie Sanders, a vote against the corporate, unethical Democratic machine. So a lot of Bernie Sanders people voted for Trump out of protest. A lot of unionists voted for Trump. We don't seem to be at a time in our life where we're willing to take on any major issue, whether it's the environment, a world filled with debt, in America especially, with cities going bankrupt, and we're not facing this. We continue to spend as if that day of reckoning will not happen. We have people losing their homes, and yet no one coming to their aid. Their neighbors, where they've been across the street for 20, 30 years, see a van pull up, and they don't go out and say, neighbor, our children played together, went to school together, we barbecued together. What can I do to help you? We see none of that, zero. We see a people who say they're concerned but then do nothing in any objective way to change a problem into a potential solution. We're moving to places that are non-sustainable, Arizona, California, though many people are now leaving California for all the right reasons. So we seem to be a completely psychically, spiritually fractured nation. I'd like to put that into there because I see nothing of the top 50 issues in the world, and especially the United States, like overcoming Citizens United so we take out money from elections, having universal health care, which I proved that could be done economically and save money, and demilitarizing the police and stopping asset forfeiture and honoring free speech instead of spying on people and demonizing people and categorizing people who exercise their free speech against corporate America as local terrorists. All the things we should be doing, none of them are we doing. Not one single thing. Your thoughts?
Well, you're painting a very stark picture. And I think to a very large degree, it's very accurate. I think there's no doubt that the world is on a downward spiral. I think there's no doubt that major issues like climate change and species extinction and deforestation and pollution of all kinds, plastic in the ocean, are getting worse and worse year by year. And that climate change in particular is spinning out of control. I think in a related matter, I think the United States of America is in the last stages of imperial consolidation. You mentioned that I wrote a book called America as Empire, where I traced the trajectory of the United States history against the trajectory of the rise and fall of imperial systems. And, you know, empires rise and empires fall. And the United States is not an exception. We rose, and I think we reached an apogee point of power during the 20th century. And I think part of what Trump represents and the paralysis in our political system, the widening gap between the rich and the poor, the impoverishment of our discourse, the perverted sense of entitlement, the crass consumerism. If you look at imperial systems, these symptoms are all there in the late stages of an imperial decline. If you look at Arnold Toynbee's work, who studied, I think, 23 extant civilizations that at least we know about. If you look at Edward Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, or William Durant's, you know, Story of Civilization, they all talk more or less about the same thing, that when an imperial system begins to collapse, more and more power is concentrated in the center among the elites. The mass majority of people are treated like chattel. Notions of civic responsibility are exchanged for personal entitlement. Everybody's getting screwed, so why care? And the rich no longer feel a sense of patronage to a nation state because most of their money is offshore. It happened in Rome. It happened in Britain. It happened among the Ottoman empires, and now it's happening to the United States. And I think that the extraordinary phenomenon of Trump, just to bring in two other elements, which I know you've talked about before, Gary, but I think that a very important book that I would recommend all your listeners read is a recent book by Naomi Klein called No Is Not Enough, where she points out two fundamental truths about Donald Trump. One of the reasons why Trump is out of control, one of the reasons why he's unstoppable or seems to be, at least at this point, is because he's not playing by the rules of politics. He's playing by the rules of brand. He's a super brand. And, you know, Naomi Klein in her book No Logo tracks the rise of the super brands. And she points out that, you know, 75 years ago, companies, you know, built products and the products were built with quality and they stood by their products. And then in the 1980s and increasingly in the 1990s, companies like Apple, companies like Nike, companies like Starbucks began to realize that the product was not the brand. An idea was a brand. Think different. Just do it. You know, drink Starbucks. And once they realized that, they began to extend their brand across a range of products. They began to build their products, you know, offshore. they begin to impoverish one nation after another. And basically, if you look, and this is the second point that she makes, you know, what's happening in the United States now is what the United States has been doing to Latin America, Africa, Asian countries for several centuries. The elites now are treating the United States like they've been treating the third world, you know, interfering in their politics, manipulating their elections. What Russia has done to the United States in the 2016 presidential election, the United States has done to scores of countries, and not just recently, but beginning in the early 19th century, most particularly in Latin America. And what we need to realize about Trump, and this is to your point, is that Trump is not an aberration. Trump is a conclusion. Trump is the cause, not effect. It's the ugly face of neoliberalism, because neoliberalism that we used to apply elsewhere is now being applied to the United States through the shock doctrine. And Donald Trump is a master of the super brand. He's a master of the shock doctrine. And a part of the wake up that we as Americans on the left are having to go through is that our political system was becoming so corrupted by money that whether you were Democrat or Republican, you were basically representing the billionaire class. And you're absolutely right. There's fundamentally very little difference between Barack Obama and Hillary and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush Senior and Junior, you know, Ronald Reagan, and now Donald Trump. Donald Trump is just uglier. He's just more crass. He's putting it in everybody's face. But this notion of racial politics, you know, the manipulation of race and pitting one race against another race has been endemic in U.S. history from the very beginning. We built American capitalism off stolen indigenous land and stolen people of color from Africa. And it hasn't changed much since. But now the chickens are coming home to roost. And that's the extraordinary moment, I think, that we've come to. And the question is whether in the face of the ugly American, Donald Trump, who's putting it in our face and in the face of the world, what the natural consequence of the system that we've allowed called neoliberalism externally and monopoly capitalism economically, whether this is going to spin out of control or whether there's any conscience left. And right now, I think we are teetering on the brink of a totalitarian system in name as well as in fact, and whether the residue of the free press, the residue of an independent judiciary, whether the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives, whether there's any spine left anywhere sufficient to stopping this momentum, I think is the most fundamental question in the world. If the United States does not stop Donald Trump, in my opinion, all is lost, because he will consolidate. And I guarantee you, if you think the 2016 presidential election is or was manipulated by the Russians, the 2020 election will be even more so. A lot of people didn't catch, but last week, the Trump administration stripped away in all the major agencies of the U.S. government, Homeland Security, State Department, the state, the federal apparatuses, any mechanisms to keep the Russians from even deeper manipulation. So if we're at a an extraordinary moment, Gary, where we could lose even the veneer of democracy and capitalism. And if you saw the speech of Mike Pence, the vice president, in Germany to a major conference on international affairs, when he said, "I bring greetings from the president of the United States, Donald Trump," not a single person clapped. It was dead silence. The world is stunned by the betrayal of the United States to every principle upon which we were founded. And distortions included, we still brought into the world, an ethos of liberty that has burned rather brightly, but Donald Trump is snuffing out with the heel of his boot. And Jim, we need to pay attention to that and rectify it as soon as possible through impeachment.
I disagree with that. I would share a difference of opinion. I would say that we lost all credibility when we invaded and usurped the power of the people in 69 different countries since the end of World War II, causing 20 million deaths. Long ago, anyone who's aware of the truth of our body politic realizes that we didn't just drop the baton of seeming exceptional, we buried it. And
yes,
so the people who want Trump, the people want Trump out are the deep state, and they've finally shown their hand. Do you realize that every banking executive, every major medical corporation, industrialist, every single person in the military industrial complex, the big oil and nuclear and fracking industries, all of the major players in Washington, all universally back Hillary Clinton. And with her record and her husband's record and Obama's record, that shows what we would have gotten. So instead of a dark, demented fool, we would have had someone who would have gotten away with anything they wanted to and taken us further into taking away our rights and freedoms. There's no good outcome to the worst of both. And if people are smart, they'll start looking at independent third parties to bring some sensibility and ethics. We had Jill Stein, we had Rocky Anderson, we had Ralph Nader. Less than 1% of the public ever voted for him. So shame on the American public for staying what I coined the phrase, intentionally ignorant, intentionally negligent, where we intend not to know the truth because we may have to act on it. We intend to stay stupefied because then we can say, "I didn't know." So as long as we can say, "I didn't know," it exonerates us from any responsibility, as if every American is somehow today a new modern version of Pontius Pilate. They wash their hands and go watch the Cretaceans on the television.
Yeah.
I remember when you were last on the program, we discussed social change amidst crisis, and you noted that there was a natural flow to history, but that this natural flow is blocked by violence and repression. I'd like for you to elaborate on that natural flow of history. And then second, are the things really that different today, aside from climate crisis, than in ancient or earlier times? There has always been conflicts between forces of power and the abuse of power. Civilizations and empires have always arisen and collapsed. And so is our current historical situation really that unique, or is it simply we have failed to learn any lessons of history? And if today's situation is unique in some ways, how so? And last, there was a time in the Renaissance when there was the de' Medici family, and they were arguably one of the leading six families in the world promoting arts of all types. And they sponsored poets and from Shakespeare to Michelangelo. But the most interesting of the de' Medici's was not the founder, but rather the third in line, which was Lorenzo. And one of the things he did is he got one of the world's greatest philosophers to sit at a table on a weekly basis, whether it was Raphael, who was a protege of Michelangelo, or Michelangelo, or any of the others, and he asked the following: if we're going to sponsor something, then shouldn't it be for the benefit of everyone? And he would bring in an architect and an engineer, and he would say, let us make this commonplace uniquely uncommon. And the architect would say, well, then we should have the three things that all people, no matter what their class or position, can appreciate: balance, symmetry, and beauty. So whether it was one of the town squares, one of the public gardens, it had to have those three things. And then it was to the philosopher, who would frequently try to tame the egos, and Michelangelo was a raving egotist, and say, this is not about you. This is about we. You're merely getting the benefit of this largesse so that you can, from Lorenzo de' Medici, so that you can make it a sculptor or help with the Sistine Chapel. We're giving you an opportunity to share your unique artistic genius so we all benefit from it. Now, think of that, and then think of the last time that we had someone who was a powerful banker who insisted upon having the finest philosophical mind to help guide the artist so that what was created had balance, symmetry, and beauty. Because after that, after about 400 years of the Renaissance, then we went into the me of the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers, the Frisk, the Mellons, the Goulds, the Swearingens, the people who had unlimited amounts of money. And that whole philosophy thing went to the sideline, and it was just they built themselves monuments to their own ego. You would actually have to go back to Catherine the Great, who was probably the last female in power, who built so many wonderful things and held that same philosophy. Your thoughts on how that period of time and those few people were responsible for some of the greatest works of art and creativity and inspiration that we've ever had. And it was not because they were great artists. It was because they had a great philosopher helping guide them.
Well, yes, I that's why I referred to the Renaissance at the beginning of my remarks. You know, Lorenzo the Magnificent, they called him, the grandson of Cosimo, the founder of the Medici dynasty. And he brought together, architects and musicians and philosophers, and they had salons on a regular basis. And Michelangelo participated, Raphael participated. And it's also the case that two of the great chancellors of Florence, Savatari and Bruni, developed this whole notion of humanism, that in the face of the Catholic Church, everything about God above and beyond, the Renaissance and the spirit of the Greco-Roman civilization, you know, man the measure of all things, know thyself. The Medici family brought to its highest zenith by Lorenzo, became Renaissance individuals, and that we even today say he's a Renaissance man or she's a Renaissance woman. And what we mean by that is an individual who is multidimensional and synthesizes all the different aspects of a personality into one beautiful being that represents balance and symmetry and beauty, remembering Plato's notion of truth, beauty, and goodness. And you're absolutely right. If you look at the philanthropists that have risen up, you know, in the industrial period, almost without exception, like Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation, what are they doing? They're funding the pharmaceutical industry to take vaccines all over the world. They're as crass in their philanthropy as they are crass in the way they, you know, made their money. and the absence of the Renaissance elegance and ethos is a painful indictment against our modernity, and one of the reasons why the world is in such a predicament. Now, I would say, just to comment on your point about the flow of social events, I would make just two comments, Gary. One is the great observation of Edward Gibbon in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, where he said that the one law that he felt as a historian was completely constant was the law of unintended consequences. And he says, even if you're the Caesar and you are in the top of the heap, every act has unintended consequences, because the multifariousness of the world and the random elements of nature, fate, society, politics, economics, geography, culture are so complex that you make an act, even a decree, as the Caesar, it goes into the system and it always ends up somewhere else. And I think that for me is very salutary, because what it means is that there's an unpredictability to nature. There's an uncertainty about history. And if you look back over history, very few of the conspiracy theories ever turned out to be the case, because it's really very challenging, even for the most sophisticated people, the most powerful people in the world, to control enough of the random elements to ensure continuity of their particular kind. So there's a turbulence. And if you even go back over the last 50 years and you get what the futurists predict is going to happen, what actually happened has virtually in every instance never been predicted. That is how unpredictable history, society, and nature is. And to me, that means that my acts, what you do through PRN, what I'm doing through Ubiquity, what Naomi Klein is doing through her books, you know, there's a balance that is underneath the surface of things. And sometimes small little quantitative accumulations over time will create a shift of state. And then all of a sudden the worm turns. And I went through it personally with the fall of the Soviet Union. I was very engaged with the Soviet Union at very, very high levels during the 1980s. I knew Mr. Gorbachev. I knew Yeltsin. I knew Gorbachev's foreign minister, Shevardnadze, the members of the Politburo. And at the time, a week before the fall of the Berlin Wall, not a single Sovietologist anywhere in the United States or the world would have predicted that the Soviet Union would collapse. And it did. And it did very quickly, and it did almost nonviolently. Nobody expected that. And so for me, as we look at history and we see, you know, what's the old saying, you know, that evil sits on the throne and truth is always on the scaffold. And in that sense, to your observation, you know, since the rise of civilization, civilization by its very nature is coercive. And there's always been the elites, and there's always been the oppressed. And the elites over 5,000, 6,000 years of civilizational history I don't know of a single example. Maybe there's one or two where the elites ever voluntarily gave up power. It has always had to be seized through revolution or uprising or protest. And it's been ever thus. It's that way today. But the unpredictability means that it's a much more porous system. And I would conclude by just making the observation of Martin Luther King that in the end, he says, and he had to deal with the boot of everything that you're talking about and I've been talking about as a black man in the South in the 1950s and 60s in the United States, where there were still Jim Crow laws and colored only and white only signs in Birmingham, Alabama. But even then, he said in the final analysis, the universe bends toward justice. And I don't know how it's all going to work out, but I do know that I feel confident that if I give 100% of what my actions can mean and my intent can manifest in the world day by day, and I know you do, and I know there are millions of people around the world and all the NGOs and all the progressive movements, all the protesters, and we may not seem like we're making any difference, but my belief is that if we continue keeping on, we'll continue to shape history in unpredictable ways that will ensure human survival and the beginnings of a global civilization that over time will justify the efforts that we've put in and the sacrifices that we have made.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Jim. Final thought. Perhaps you know Mary Ellen Evelyn Tucker. She teaches religion and ecology at Yale University, and I think she was a student of the great cosmologist and theologian Friar Thomas Berry. And then she was the chief editor of a series of about a dozen books, each exploring ecological stances of the different world religions. And unfortunately, I cannot find myself defining any of the main religions, let's call them modern civilizations, religions with holy books or creeds as being truly ecological. Certainly, there are ecological elements that can be teased out of every religion. However, these religions possess overriding, pervasive, dominant mythologies and doctrines that undermine an authentic ecological consciousness. In particular, are the dominant myths that elevate our human species to a state of what would I call it, of hierarchical superiority and rulership over all of creation, an emphasis on patriarchal imagery and values that undermine or deny feminine values, usually identified with nature and ecology. And the real proof of my assertion is to ask what major religion has not destroyed the environment and ecosystems and biodiversity when and where it was a dominant political force. And this begs my question. If the faith traditions are not the solution for a dramatic transformation of consciousness in order to fully embrace a deeper ecological awareness, then how can this be accomplished? And is it therefore not time that we take the indigenous spiritualities, which are rooted and grounded in ecological awareness, more seriously? You just have 2 minutes.
Yes, you're hitting this, in my view, the $64,000 point. And if I had to reduce my view on this to a simple statement, I would say even as we have to transcend fossil fuels and go completely into renewable clean technology, so we need to transcend the axial religions and move into a completely new earth-based spirituality. I do not believe we'll ever solve the first problem if we don't solve the question of our basic identity as spiritual beings. We need to liberate ourselves from the Abrahamic religions, from Judaism, from Christianity, from Islam, from Hinduism, from Buddhism. They've been ecologically devastating. Probably only Taoism had any real notion of ecological sanctity. So, yes, and I think that's one of the extraordinary movements in the world today is toward the rise of a new spirituality, and we're going to need it to empower our shift from fossil fuels to renewable energy.
Good. Taoism, and I would include Jainism in there as well.
Yeah.
And I want to leave people with just the idea. There's a philosopher, social philosopher, and his name is Morris Berman, and he wrote a trilogy on the collapse of American culture, The Twilight of American Culture and The Dark Age of America. And basically, it was a very prophetic examination, although very caustic, about the decline of Western civilization. He's pessimistic and feels there's little society can do anymore to arrest the onset of corporate mass media culture, and that what is now demanded is a new kind of new monistic individual who would preserve the literary, philosophical, and historical treasures of our civilization. And before we decline any further into this new dark age, I just want the people in this audience to be aware there are some critical thinkers, and let us not put them on the sideline because they're older or because they're not mainstream media darlings. And Jim Garrison is one of those people who we need at this time for his wisdom. Website, ubiquityuniversity.org and wisdomuniversity.org. Thank you, Jim, for being on today.
Thank you, Gary. You're doing great work.
Appreciate it. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love.